Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Soleil, second language acquisition for everyone. We are here this week. This podcast will be coming out the week of Actful. So if you're listening on a plane or waiting for something, hi, see you there. We are releasing this podcast as a summary of the book study that we as a community have been completing on the book Proficiency-Based Instruction, Teaching Grammar for Proficiency by Ritz and Travers, published by Actful. We're very excited. We've been engaging in this book study across our social media accounts, and we've also been doing it slow chat style. So if you missed out on something, go ahead and comment back. It'll bring it back into people's feeds and we can keep the conversation going. Don't be afraid if you're hopping on late. But we've been very excited about this, and we have been leading it together, me and Bill, with our excellent, wonderful, very slay colleague, Stacy Witkowski, who is here on the pod with us this very day. Hello, Stacy.
Hi,
Welcome.
Ben. Thank you for that sweet introduction. It's good to see you again on Zoom. I am Stacy Witkowski. I am currently teaching middle school Spanish. I have also, in the past, taught elementary Spanish and high school French and English to Japanese speakers. And I am excited to be learning about teaching grammar and context and happy to be here on the podcast with you.
I met Stacy through the context of online connections. So we met across social media, which again, get connected, everybody. But also, Stacy and I work together on the Language Learner Literature Advisory Board, which I will drop the link to in the show notes. And they will be presenting at Actful as well about their work in examining language learner literature for issues of identity and bias. And yeah, do you have anything to say about the
Yeah,
presentation, Stacy?
I'm happy to say that our presentation is called Cutting It Out, Curating Our Classroom Library, and I will be presenting with members of lab, including Dr. Esmeralda Mora and Christy Lentz, and we are looking forward to seeing some old and making new friends at ACTFL.
Do you have a time in a room off the
I
top of your
do.
head? We can always
I
just
do
add it
have a
to the
time in a room off
notes.
the top of my head. We are going to be presenting at 5:30 p.m. on Friday in room 213.
Wonderful. Friday, 5:30, 2:13.
Not to
Be there.
piggyback on that, as well as my only like presentational function at Actful this year is going to be leading an Actful sidebar about supporting LGBTQ plus students and colleagues. And so that is in the main exhibition hall. If you want to come see me and chat about that, that is in the main exhibition hall at the sidebar, which is just like a stand-up conversation loosely based on whatever interests or thoughts you're having related to the topic. And I'm doing that on Saturday from 11 to 11:45. So come say hi.
I think Stacy and I went to that together last year, didn't we? Yeah, it was a good time. It was like just, community. Having a community around, being able to have a visible community at the National Language Teacher Convention was special. So
Grateful for the
have a great
opportunity
time
to
with
talk
it.
about that,
Yeah.
especially right now in our history. So, alrighty, let's get down to seamlessly moving on from discussions of Actful. Let's get into the book. Let's get down to business. Proficiency-based instruction, teaching grammar for proficiency. This is a pretty hefty book. I think it came out to, what was it? I was reading, finishing it up today, and it's like 250-ish, 270 pages of material. So there was a lot there. In a typical episode, we would gaslight gatekeep girl boss about one specific topic that is very small, but there's a lot going on in the book. So what we're going to do in this episode instead is gaslight. We're going to talk about some issues that we have had with teaching grammar for proficiency before and or things that we struggled with while reading the book. So struggles before and or during the book reading. Gatekeep will kind of highlight the gems that come out of the book specifically, and there were lots. And then Girl Boss will kind of take it into takeaway land and slay into the sunset. So to start us off, let's talk about gaslight. What are some things that we have struggled with in teaching grammar for proficiency?
So I think for me, first of all, is like as someone who anytime I'm like making a lesson or an assessment, I'm always thinking about how can I like focus in on maybe some of these grammar functions without just going totally metalinguistic, talking about taking off verb endings, adding verb endings. And like my typical approach to that has been, a mix of pop-up grammar. Love pop-up grammar. So like we're talking. Oh, did you notice that I said this? That's because blank, move on. And then over time, they've heard those little explanations over and over and over. That's something Dr. Diane Neubauer and I did a presentation on pop-ups 1 year about how it's like it's slow and piecemeal. I'm not quizzing students over the things, over the little pop-ups that I give or anything, but she framed it as a statistical learning, like a statistical learning model. So like repeated exposure over and over and over. Hopefully it sinks in at some point. So I do pop-up grammar. I don't know if I do it enough to get like that same, like that statistical learning approach. I don't know if I'd call it approach, but like concept of statistical learning. But also another thing that I struggled with before, and I think this is something that the book did really well, was explaining and giving examples of what it means to teach grammar as a concept. So we can talk about that later, but like going in, like, we've got our, is it six high leverage teaching practices? It's 10.
They released a second book. Well, okay, here's the thing, is that there's like the actual core practices, and then there's the high leverage teaching practices, and then
Right.
there's the high voltage electricity converter, and then there's the high stakes negotiation.
You
And there's a
forgot the
lot, all that to
platinum
say
card
to for the listeners is
practices
that there's
and the
a lot of
gold
different.
card practices,
Yeah, and then there's a crossover
the diamond
document
card
that, yeah, that, yeah,
practices.
you, exactly. The platinum visa practices. There's a lot of crossover between these terms. In terms of high leverage teaching practices, there are 10 listed out by Actful in two books. Core practices, I believe
Core
there are
practices.
six, which again, not to be semantic, but
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of. So the six core practices, one of which the focus of the book, grammar as a concept. So really I didn't have a working definition for it for myself. So I was happy to get a little bit of clarification there. And I think there were some good examples of what it looks like and what it means to like think about your unit. Think about a unit, and as you're backwards designing and whatnot, like what kind of language will students need to be able to use for this task or this assessment at the end of this unit? And making sure to introduce it in, I mean, a mix of ways. The book talks about a couple different ways of introducing grammar as input. But yeah, so that was helpful, but that was something that I had definitely struggled with before.
So grammar as a concept being
Yeah.
that grammar is something that conveys meaning.
Yes.
It is not a
Yeah.
fun
So like
abstract thing we
even
talk about. It's something
yeah.
that makes it so that you can understand the message, that you can convey the messages you want to convey, or understand the messages you want
Exactly.
to understand.
So, and I can talk more about that when I gatekeep a little bit about structured input, 'cause that's my babe. That's my baby. I love it so much.
I want to talk a little bit about some things that I struggled with. But first, I want to give a shout out to Bill's pop-up grammars. He mentioned that he had given a session with Diane Neubauer, and I had the privilege of attending one of Bill's sessions on pop-up grammar. It was at one of our CI conferences. And to be honest, after reading this book, I think that what I learned from Bill is just as valuable as what I've learned, in the sense that when we talk about like what was an area of struggle for me, like I knew I didn't want to teach grammar like I had learned grammar from the textbook, but I had never really had like a full class where I sat down and thought about like how do I do this? Right? In the CI world, we've had lots and lots of workshops on how to teach vocabulary and how to stay in the target language and how to teach like the weekend chat and the calendar. But all of that is focused on meaning, but grammar is important too. So how am I supposed to do that? And so that was kind of excited about that coming into this book. And they talked about lots of different stuff. They talked about the score and the speaking and framing your task. And they talked about the PACE model of noticing the grammar. And I came away from all of that going, you know, I'm going to take this little tidbit and I'm going to take this little tidbit and I'm going to take this little tidbit. But as far as an overarching model, I think I'm going back to pop-up grammar. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. Like, it all fits in right there.
Yeah. And I think, like, for one, it doesn't take a lot away from the communicative activities that we're trying to do. Right. Since you gave a shout out, I'll also give a shout out. I think for me, like, my interest in at least structured input started with Common Grounds by Florencia Henshaw and Maris Hawkins. Like, they had some really good concrete examples, and like, it got me really interested. And that was just kind of like a taste of it. I still didn't really get like how to make them myself. Like, I understood the idea, but yeah, that just like an additional thing that's, it's still input based. And like, I don't think any of us, this is kind of a different thought, sorry. But I don't think any one of us or anyone should disagree with the fact that comprehensible input is necessary for language acquisition. Like, you can go to all these different studies that talk about what is the basis of language learning, blah, blah, blah. Comprehensible input. The question's always been, is comprehensible input on its own enough? And obviously there's different thoughts on that. So this has kind of been my thought of like, okay, CI plus some structured input stuff, or at least, at the very least, like input processing and processing instruction a little bit, like arranging a text in such a way that you kind of have to force students to notice the grammatical form. Like, for example, one of the principles of input processing is the preference for non-redundancy. So if a sentence is three people are talking on a podcast, you don't really, which that's a bad example, but
I think it'd work.
Yeah. But like, or no, here's, yeah. Yeah. So three people, they don't have to, a learner wouldn't have to recognize that people is plural.
And also have to not even recognize R, right? As they
might not, yeah, exactly.
To be, right?
Yeah, because we get all of that information by saying three people. So if we get rid of that, then like, you can like split that up, and you could say, like, in a quick activity, one person is recording a podcast, and three people, separate it, are recording a podcast, and students would have to like match those, but they would have to understand what the difference between is and are would be in order to correctly respond.
I'm with Stacy in the like the how of it, because I think that pop-up grammar, I've been thinking, listen, hearing this conversation about pop-up grammar, kind of what popped into my mind is like, when to do what? Like, when do I pop up the verb ending? When do I pop up the articles in German? When do I pop up the word placement? That sort of thing. And one thing that the book contended that I thought was very interesting is that often and historically our assessments and expectations have not matched their expected actful proficiency levels. For instance, in second year language courses is often where we hit the past tenses, for instance, and maybe depending on the level of grammatical wackiness, they might be like, and future and conditional and everything. But those functions, being able to control those functions with fidelity is more a marker of being an advanced speaker of a language. So being able to differentiate past, present, future clearly is what ACFL describes as an advanced speaker. And so that there has just been a historical mismatch between the expectations that we have. But it got me thinking, a couple of different parts of this book got me thinking about the ACFL levels being used in this way and wondering, do the ACFL levels describe actual language development as it happens in the brain, or do they describe something else? Do they describe use, language use for specific situations? This came up a couple times on our book study online. Stacy asked, oh, there's an intermediate low target unit that is just targeting present tense third person verb forms. That to me feels like a, an earlier, like a novice sort of unit sort of thing. And from what I know, from what I've learned from Dr. Vilben Patten, for instance, about the natural order is that the unmarked verb, especially like in Spanish, is the first thing to come. So like the, habla, dice, those sorts of things are the first one to come. So in my mind, I was like, oh, that should be the first thing. I don't know why they would target that this much later. But then that kind of like dissonance of being like, oh, but the natural order, with later thinking about how the authors on page 237, for instance, contend that at the end of a curricular unit, students should be demonstrating close to full control of a target pattern from the curricular unit. I kind of bristled against that because I was like, but wait, the natural order, what if their brain isn't ready for that? Like, what if that's not where they are in their specific year language acquisition? Do we have, again, a grammatical syllabus that we're ticking off? They're ready for this, ergo, they're going to have acquired it by this, 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 and this. I started to go, uh-oh. I think using the ACTFL levels to describe what we do in class is helpful because it speaks to what students are able to do. But when we use it for this way, for expectations for what grammatical form students are able to acquire or produce later, I think we kind of get into danger zone. And I have kind of come away from this book still ambiguous in my feelings about how we use those levels.
Ben, you asked what actually are the early acquired grammar, and I've been running a long-term experiment on myself where I'm acquiring Korean without taking any Korean classes, basically by playing with Duolingo and watching K-dramas. And I, as you were talking, I asked myself, all right, so what was the first verb form that I acquired in Korean? Was it the infinitive? And I was like, no, maybe it was like the usual, like the daily, like the present tense verb. And I was like, no, the very first tense I acquired was the command form, because it was used all by itself, one word with space around it. And I heard it and I understood it. And the very first thing I acquired was the command form. And then I started thinking about my class. And you know what the very first thing my students acquire? The command form, because I have class jobs. And so when I say, cierra la puerta or apaga la luz, they are now saying that to each other in Spanish 1. In October, they're giving each other commands. That's not in a textbook grammar sequence the first thing that we're expected to teach.
So it's about use. It's about what happens in the situations, what the kind of input that they're receiving, right?
Yeah, and I think something else about, like, just kind of maybe a disclaimer on natural order. Like, there are grammatical features that have been studied, like present progressive and English language learners has been studied pretty well. Like, that's something that comes up very quickly or is acquired pretty quickly. But then third person S markers, not as acquirable as we'd like them to be in the time given, because in Spanish, we don't have to give subjects. So if someone's learning English with their heritage language or home language as Spanish, like going back to preference for non-redundancy principle, like if it says he, we don't pay attention to if it's have or has, right? So like maybe a learner learns I have, you have, we have, they have, and then they just know They see he or she or they, singular, have. So, like, also, because in English, only, like, one form in a lot of cases is different. Like, that's the only one, the third person singular is the only one that gets that S to mark that it's he or she does. That's to say, even if we know what the order of development of a specific grammatical feature is, that's not a teaching tool for us. It's a description of what we're likely to see in student production. So Sarah Nassar has been studied very well, and I think Dr. Bill Van Patten has done a study on that. And like it's a pretty clear order that all students will go through. Like it's overuse of ser, then like drop the verb completely, and then over reliance on, then start to get a star with gerunds, and then get it, and I probably have this order wrong, but it's something like that. I know that like there's overgeneralization of ser, there's a part where like they just stop putting in is or am. So you might see students at the beginning of the year saying el hombre es alto, but just because of how language development works, at some point, even though they were doing it perfectly before, we know that they're very likely to just drop that verb in sentences of like description. And then, you know, it goes on, but there's a very well studied pattern of what happens. And so I think for us, it's just like noticing, knowing that information helps us understand that students are going through the process.
It reminds me of when I learned that like weather predictions, when we say there's like an X percent chance of rain, it's not that there is a this like statistical probability chance of rain. It's that in at that many percentage of scenarios where like the weather conditions look like it does right now, it rained, that it's like more about the modeling versus than the actual like statistical probability. So that's what that comparison came up when you're describing like, yeah, there are sequences that people generally go through, but whether or not we can say something probabilistically is going to happen or not is kind of not there. And so again, I think using these actual levels to be like, well, now that they're intermediates, now that they're like solidly intermediate mid, we can start targeting advanced level functions. I don't know that I can with certainty say like their brains are ready for X function because I don't have the access to that information. The kind of like corollary to that point that I had a problem with was we talk a lot about maintaining target language environments in the classroom. We talk about developmental appropriateness, and that was a part of this book as well. But there was an assertion on pages 99 and 100 in the book that we should be doing, having students discuss and co-construct grammar rules as part of the PACE model using the target language. And the justification that was given is that you shouldn't do it in the common language because what's on page 32 is not what lands up in your head, which is a Bill Van Pattenism. And that there has been this historical developmental mismatch between grammar targets. But I don't think that answers the question of why, if the topic of grammar is very abstract, grammar is just an abstract thing. It's talking about language fully removed from its function. Abstract topics are more markers of advanced or superior speakers of a language, being able to talk in abstraction. So if that's the case, I don't know how we can make the argument that students should spend the significant cognitive resources it would take to learn vocabulary related to grammar in the L2, which they might not know in L1, to then discuss abstractly something, again, something so abstract that is like an advanced or subject world. I just don't see the, like, you're not getting a lot of juice for that squeeze, in my humble opinion.
I agree. Trying to teach grammar in the target language, I teach novices right now. I teach middle schoolers, Spanish 1 and Spanish 2. They're not sure what a verb is in English. And to try to explain all of this in Spanish would take me so far back up to pre-teach all the vocabulary needed to talk about vocabulary. Is taking time away that I could be using to talk about our unit content goals?
It kind of circles back to the, like, what we were talking about earlier is like pop-up grammar. Like, just give a short, the shortest possible kid-friendly explanation of what's happening meaning-wise with a form, and then move on. And if you do it a lot of times, maybe they'll internalize just a memorized phrase about those grammatical forms, and maybe that's good enough. And that they just will have that in the back of their mind as they're absorbing new language. One final assertion, and maybe this is like a personal thing for me, is that when talking about choosing resources, early in the book, page 54, they were talking about leveled readers and, you know, whether or not to choose authentic resources or teacher-created, you know, I don't want to say learner-centered, but made for language learning situations sort of resources. And the assertion was that leveled readers are unnatural because of the repetition they provide. I saw that as potentially an advantage, but also that they are inauthentic and that we should just use the experiences of the teacher as a way to avoid bias. And I just think that that is not, and maybe because, especially because Stacy's here and we've done a lot of work on bias in these sorts of readers, that we can't really assert that there will be no bias if you take those out of the question, because every person brings bias into the classroom. And so just again, that maybe this is like my personal hill to die on, but I'm like, yeah, like everything is going to have bias, and it's the cognizance of that that makes a strong teacher in helping students dissect those things and learn about their own identities and think critically about other identities. So maybe that was my little plug for, you know, language learner readers I have seen as great springboards for lots of really authentic learning and communication that pushed against bias, that has also at sometimes reinforced bias. But I think any text can be a springboard for conversation based on how it's used by the teacher.
I totally agree with you, Ben, that trying to eliminate bias by eliminating pre-made resources, that's not effective, because as you said, every teacher carries bias. You just have to be careful. I do want to give some credit to Ritz and Travers, because on page 54, they have written, a balance of authentic and some teacher-made resources is truly the best of both worlds and helps keep communication and culture at the forefront of your classroom. And I can agree with that. I can get behind that we need both. We need the resources created by and for teachers, specifically for language learners, to get all of that repetition and that scaffolding that we need. And we need, even from level one, authentic texts, authentic resources, authentic images, because what are we doing? We are teaching a language. Are we teaching about the language? We need to bring in the conversation, the people who own this, who live this every day.
Also, like in chapter 3, something that I liked that they said, it's important to keep in mind that while the resources should be comprehensible to learners, as with authentic resources, in line with teacher-created resources as well, you additionally want to provide new input and help them push beyond their developmental level and be engaging to read or listen to. This might mean including some new terms or writing your text in a more natural way. You want to ensure that what you write isn't too far beyond your learner's proficiency, while also challenging them to interpret an engaging resource. So, which I think that kind of like goes along, like as long as like when we're looking for authentic resources, like we also need to make sure that those are accessible. And like, I know that like, you know, at certain levels, like in Spanish 4, they're going to go on to AP next year. I know that a skill that they're going to need to be able to do is to become familiar or like comfortable with unfamiliarity. So like, that's when we bring in authentic resources and like we work on that skill. Like, what can you get even if you don't understand everything? But I also try to not, I mean, I don't want to overwhelm them, like, because cognitive load, you know, throw too much new stuff at them, like, and hope something will stick. Probably very little will stick. So, like, I think it's a very delicate balance. Hey, are we ready to gatekeep or ungatekeep?
Let's talk about the wisdom that came out of reading this book, because, We had some things that we struggled with coming in, but I think there were also plenty of things in the book that were usable, that provoked thought. Stacey, what kind of stuck out to you first that you ungatekeeped and is now applicable to your practice?
Well, there were a lot of things that I was able to take away from this. One of the things that I thought was really striking is that, you know, when they talk about teaching grammar, the first thing they said was give them some input. And not only did they say give them some input, that was like a really big takeaway that when you're teaching grammar, start with input. And then this was the part that was new to me. They were very explicit that every time you give them a text, you are going to read it twice or listen to it twice. And not just listen to it twice, but you're going to do two separate comprehension tasks with that text. And I was like, why am I spending so much time looking for different texts? I need to be recycling. I need to be using and squeezing these texts so that not just my high-flying students understood it, but by the time we've read it twice and done two different texts, everybody in the room has read it, understood it, feels comfortable, and then we can move on. Is that something that you guys are doing?
I co-presented with Alicia Dahlman Shoemaker, the Actful Teacher of the Year from my year, and one of her presentation at the regional conferences was about aha moments in intercultural competence. And students do need time to like chew on resources and things that they've learned and have some more life experiences in between and come back to it. So even if those kind of two readings or viewings happen on different days, that gives students time to like subconsciously process some of the things that they experienced. And I think that that also, and again, the chance to chew on the input again. I feel the need to close off every lesson within one class period, but lessons can be longer. And that actually helps also with retrieval practice, if you're thinking about that in terms of building strong memories of things learned, which is not necessarily the same thing as language acquired. But yeah, I think that, yeah, take the time. And I feel the same way as you, Stacey, where I was like, oh, I had them read it one time and then they did or did not get it. And then we talked about it a bunch and then moved on. It's like, oh, take your time. Multiple passes. It helps.
An aha for me was, and I don't know what page it was on or what chapter it was in, but I think it was the preparing students for like, what was it? Preparing learners to focus on form and input first and meaning. What is it? Keep input first and meaning based. So like the question comes up like, why don't we teach the grammar rules first? And because that's, I think typically that's what tends to happen is you get introduced to a grammatical term or a grammatical function or structure, and then we do present, practice, produce. But I think they gave a really good analogy for why not to do that, which was something about like, imagine someone who has never seen a baseball game and you explain all of the baseball rules to them. Like, and then you finally show them this is what a game looks like. Like that would be a weird progression. Like if someone didn't know what baseball was, I'd show them videos. I'd take them to a baseball game. I wouldn't just explain, well, there's going to be someone throwing a ball and they're kind of like in the middle of this field, but the field's also called a diamond because it's kind of in the shape of a diamond. And they throw the ball, they hit the ball with a bat, and then they run around the bases. Oh, there's three bases. Also, they can bunt. And like, so just a bunch
I
of
think that makes sense if we think about first language acquisition. Like, nobody's talking to your baby about prepositions, but if you think about like, I've spent some time in elementary schools because I used to be an elementary Spanish teacher, and when you walk into the fourth grade classroom, the fourth grade teacher is talking about prefixes and suffixes. The children have been speaking their target language for 9 years now. This is not the first thing they do. First, you get 9 years of input, and then your teacher says, hey, by the way, let's polish this, let's refine this, let's talk about the rules of the language. What's an adjective? What's a verb? What's a noun? That happens in like upper elementary school. That's a normal way to start talking about language once you've heard the language.
And also something, and this is kind of going back to order development a little bit. I saw an article posted by Timothy Chavez.
I said okay. Chalamet, but accidentally, sorry.
And he had posted an article recently about first language acquisition of Serenistar, which I know I brought this up a couple times already. Sorry. So Serenistar, for our non-Spanish teachers, they're both verbs that mean to be. Yeah. And Ben is showing me on his camera the like one of the big takeaways is that even first language learners of Spanish were still being corrected on when to use ser and estar up until like age 10. So, but we expect it to happen in a school year before they've had any of any language input. So just, that was just like something that I liked.
Something that was ungainkept to me, and maybe this will set Bill off on a 7-hour tirade of joy, is kind of just like really selling me on structured input as a way to like really drive home the processing of language forms. And they had a really interesting kind of like take on how to scaffold those and how to kind of build an on-ramp for output from input. Their kind of like assertion on pages 135 and 151 was taking students from structured input activities where they have to process the language correctly in order to answer the questions correctly, from referential to affective answers, referential being stuff that has a clear right or wrong answer. So for instance, if we're saying, who did this activity? Me, who was talking about it, or my friend over there, who I'm talking about in the third person? That's not how they would say it at all, but you get the idea. And so you're looking through and you say, I walk the dog every day, go to the gym, speaks four languages. You know, that one has that S on the end, so the learner has to process the S and say, oh, he's not talking about himself, he's talking about this third person. Those sorts of things have clear right or wrong answers purely from a linguistic standpoint. And maybe you had given some sort of profile of these two people where like, so-and-so does this all the time and so-and-so does this. So that helps with the meaning part of it as well. But then the processing of the language form necessarily has to come before you get the answers correct. Those are referential. You get them right or wrong. And that our early structured input tasks, if we're really focusing on some sort of grammar structure that we want students to become familiar with, should focus more on those, that there is a right or wrong answer, so that way they have to process it and that they reprocess it. But later, as you can develop more comfort with those sorts of structures with the students, that they show greater, I don't know, maybe you've popped it up to them. You say, oh, I noticed that like all the ones just describing my friend had that little S on the end. That sure is interesting. That you later can move more towards affective answers, which are describing your opinion about something, your thoughts, your plans, your reactions to something. So it has more of a personalized take on it. And I think this is a smart way to think about how we can build those gradients between input-based tasks and output-based tasks, because there are both. Like early on, if I'm trying to get my kids to think about this structure because there's some sort of district mandate that says I have to teach XYZ verb ending or something, that in the very beginning, it can be heavily input-oriented tasks, super input, structured input stuff that has clear right or wrong answers that allows you to pop up the forms that you're talking about, but then move towards more affective things where the students are having to create an opinion and experience a reaction to the input in question. And I thought for some reason that scratched a part of my brain. And I think Stacy had mentioned that also in the somewhere across socials that was something that scratched your brain. And now Bill, take it away, Bill.
Yeah. All right. So I'll start off with just today. We're like in the middle of a unit and the schedule's weird this week. So I'm like, I've got 2 days that I don't really have plans for. So I was like, I know, it'll just be a discussion day. But I started it with a structured input activity, an effective structured input activity. So told students there are no right or wrong answers. These are all just kind of opinion based. And then we're just going to talk about it afterwards. So I gave them a list. So it was if I were an animal, or if I were X animal, I would blah 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 blah. And then I had two columns after it. So like I've got this the phrase si fuera, if I were, and then I had like seven options, so then they just start with the animal. So si fuera, so we're pointing that out. We're getting them to notice just that phrase si fuera, that it's like introducing a hypothetical situation, right? And then they had to, for each sentence, they had to mark, I would like to be this animal, or I would not like to be this animal. And then we talked more about, so they were getting a lot of exposure to the conditional, because that's kind of like what I was focusing on. I also focused it on conditional yesterday because we had a lot of snow. And so I asked students, like, if we had a snow day today, what would you do? And then I just put, like, kind of like weekend chat, just some like common verbs that they might be able to use, all with the conditional ending on them. And I also like input enhancement. So, like, I bold different parts of words or color code word a little bit too. But what I really love about effective activities really can lead to some like robust discussions. Because especially if it's something about opinion, because everyone's answer is gonna be a little different. And it's gonna be even more different if you offer more options. So if it's not just, I would like to be this animal, I would not like to be this animal, you could add other columns. I did something with Spanish one. This one was referential, so it referred to content that we've already talked about. And I was just taking a look a little bit at Sarah Nastar while we're talking about it. Because even if, like, I know that they're not going to get it right all the time, but if they have a little bit of that, like, language knowledge, maybe that'll come into play when they write and do some monitoring. But, like, that's not the goal. The goal is to understand that if this sentence uses es, but if you swap, it means this. If you swapped it out for está, it's going to mean something different. So, like, Bill está aburrido. Bill's bored. That's just telling you how I'm feeling right now. But versus Bill es aburrido, that's using es, which kind of makes it more of an inherent thing. And it would be just a different phrase. So we did es, but all they had to do for the first round, all they had to do was just mark who did this action or who does this describe. And then afterwards, I went to, is this like a description or is this like a temporary thing? Which is too basic to encompass all of the differences between Sarah and Star,
Bill,
but
did you really
yeah,
set
Stacey.
yourself up so that your students can say, Señor Langley, es aburrido? No, you wouldn't do
No, I was just giving an example for our
Did you really just
audience.
set yourself up so our audience can say, Bill, es aburrido?
Well, I mean, like, grammatically correct, factually wrong. So, but yeah, like, then we just talk a little bit about it. I did something with preterite versus imperfect last week, and instead of doing just like, is this in the preterite or is this in the imperfect? The options were, was this a one-time event or does it describe the situation? And then we did a quick explicit talk about the grammar. Okay, what do you notice? What do you notice about the things that were one event? What do you notice about the phrases that were description of the situation? And so, like, I got some answers that were like, oh, it uses imperfect. I'm like, yes, but what does that mean? So, like, the example's easier with preterite, but it's like, okay, so what all does this or io tell us? Does it tell us how many people did it? Check. And does it tell us when they did it? Check. So those are the functions. It tells us who, and it tells us when. So that's the information that we can get from the input and from the things that we're noticing, which was, I just had fun with that conversation. That was, and like going through the different things, and cómo sabemos. Oh, and then we can do some of like the, oh, because they've all got the O with the accent on it. I'm like, yeah. And then going back, what does that tell us? What information does it give us? Not just there's an O with an accent, that's preterite. There's an ia or an aba, that's imperfect. I have a
That's
lot more
great. I
to say
get
about structured input, but I'm going to let other people talk.
Bill's a structured and super fan. One thing I didn't realize, or maybe just didn't think about before I read the book, is that you can also do it with oral input. I think that in my brain, I was just like, yeah, it's like a piece of paper and they look at it. And I think that's that the most natural way to plan for the language to be that specific. But when I was like, oh, wait, it can be and should be a mix of both because students are going to hear and have to differentiate both. It made me plan a task for my students. For instance, today we are recording on Veterans Day, which is a day off from school for me in my district. And so I am going to ask my students, like, does our class spend days off from school in an active way or in a more restful sort of way? And so they're going to check off whether or not they think I likely did something or did not likely do something on the given day off based on what they know about me. And then they're going to write some more ideas like Hirfish Rodriguez did this or that or the other. And I'm sure that's going to go crazy. And then after that, I'm going to kind of essentially just narrate briefly what I did do today, which is sleep until 10, read a book, record a podcast with my buddies. I think I'll either go on a walk or do some yoga later. It's going to be a restful
Wow,
day
girl
for Fish
boss.
Rod. But then again, that's the structure that I'm trying to target is in German, and that I think this is true as French as well, is that when you talk about events in the past, you use a different auxiliary based on whether or not you are moving somewhere versus doing something at a static location. And that is in my silly little German textbook that I got to start using this year. That's like one of the grammar points they want me to hit. And so I said, bet, I'm gonna throw something in where like I walked to the park. And that's it. Like, that's the place where I went, but I'm gonna have to use those verbs of movement and those static verbs of doing stuff at home in different ways to explain that. So they're gonna read the input and see, what did he probably do? Then they're gonna hear my actual description and actually have to take notes and then, determine whether or not my day was restful or active. And then they're gonna talk to their partners about kind of the same thing. It's just like, what did you get up to? Did you do this activity? Did you do this activity? Was it more restful? And kind of summarize like, what does our class do when we have a random day off on a Tuesday, which is very goofy and silly, but here we are. So again, and this all came from the revelation, like I've always thought of it as structured input as just like purely written activities, but no.
And also, structured input doesn't just have to be about grammar. It can be about vocabulary. So, for example, if you're making true and false questions, maybe you don't just say true or false. We did an activity to prepare for the show that we watch in Spanish for, and I wanted to make sure that they knew the words sombra, shadow, and luz, light. I just wanted to really make sure that that we hit on it. So instead of true or false, we said luz o sombra. And like, okay, ¿por qué se describe sombra? Why are we describing that as shadow? Why are we describing this one as luz, light? So that gave opportunities to just hit on that vocabulary over and over and over again. Something for dear listeners to think about if you're looking into structured input. One of like the really, really key things about it, in my opinion, is you need to be very careful about not giving the answer away. So if like you're doing something where, is this something that they did already, or is this something they plan to do? In your sentences, you're not going to say words like yesterday or tomorrow, because that gets rid of the reason to pay attention. If I know yesterday, then I know that that's going to be something that they already did. If I see that it's mañana, tomorrow, I'm going to know that it's something that they're going to do. So just be keep an eye out on like how on how much information you give away. And so that students aren't just looking for singular words, but they have to process the whole thing.
I agree with you, Bill. I think focusing on stripping away the giveaway words and making students to process the words that you want to process is important. I want to go back to what Ben said for a second. What do you mean in German they use different verbs depending on if you're moving or not? That is so fascinating. You're making me want to learn German.
Yeah, so I know a guy. Yeah, no, and this is a, I believe it, if I remember correctly, it's this, it's almost the same. It's the same as French, like je suis allé versus ich bin gegangen versus j'ai mangé, ich habe gegessen.
That's amazing.
Same concept.
Before we leave our gatekeeping, I want to mention something else that I thought was kind of new and mind-blowing in this book, for me at least, and that is that when they talk about the proficiency target versus the performance target, like we've been talking a lot about actual performance descriptors, and we've been talking about proficiency, and they're not the same thing, and we shouldn't expect them to be the same. And I don't think I'd ever heard anybody smart say that out loud before, or certainly read it in a book where it like sunk in for me that, like, oh, well, of course, if I am aiming that they're going to be able to be proficient at novice high level by the end of Spanish one, and yet on this particular task that we have practiced and studied and practiced and studied and practiced and studied all week long, their performance should be much higher than that right now. That was something new for me that my brain went, oh, that's a big one, and I need this. And so, yeah, thanks, Mike and Catherine.
Thanks. Yeah, that the at the proficiency, if we know our students' proficiency is going to land in novice mid or novice high, that we're targeting intermediate performances, and even at intermediate low, because they're barely holding on, we're still targeting that intermediate performance. But once they get to intermediate mid and high, we're targeting advanced level performance up until they get to advanced mid, and that's when we move to superior. That also was kind of like news to me, and you know, I went on my little screed earlier about the actual proficiency levels and like, why? How can we use them? But I think for me, it ended up being a helpful reminder that I want to give rich input across all levels. And that was almost a reminder for me with my first and second years, who are pretty solidly novice in their proficiency, to always be giving them what I would describe as intermediate level input, which is more connected, which is more details, which has all the sort of markers of intermediate proficiency of combining sentences. Because there's always the risk, you know, I think if we're trying to do things very comprehensibly, that we write these short, choppy sentences, or we speak in these very short, comprehensible sentences that we're like, these are 100% transparent. But I think we need to remind ourselves to give rich input that it contains all of the, you know, the next generation of things for them. So connecting words and details, like I said earlier.
I have one last thing from Gatekeep, and it's from the first page of chapter one. And it's a quote from Leslie Gran. We're not asking you to get a divorce from grammar. We're asking you to redefine your relationship with it. Because you can't have language without grammar. Whether or not you can have language without discussing grammar, but like, can't say that we don't teach the grammar because I'm teaching the grammar every single time that I point out, oh, why is there an N on the end of this word? And then students say, because multiple people are doing it. That's all I need. Like, I need, like, there's, you have an understanding of what that additional letter means. But it's not like I didn't just give them a bunch of drills saying, put this in the third person plural, put this in the third person plural. It's just, hey, there's an N here. We do that when we talk about more than one person. Girl bossing?
Yeah, what have we done well? What have we come away from this with, like our main takeaways, or I don't know, th things that we were reaffirmed in our practices. For me, I think I read a whole book about feedback, and I kind of went on this like big feedback kick Once I like, I don't know, I was like dipped into the Hattieverse and they were like, feedback is the biggest indicator of like moving student learning forward. And I was like, but what could feedback look like if we're not providing feedback about learning, but rather acquisition that we're working on with something implicit? So I've thought a lot about this. And so a lot of the feedback that I give ends up being more implicit. And I liked in the book, they talked about using dictogloss as form-focused feedback. So another sort of input focused thing that is a springboard for more output eventually, but they provide instructions for how a dictogloss could happen and be used as form focused feedback for students to think about grammar forms that if teachers have seen patterns of error. I think you could also do a traditional dictation much for a similar effect, still have focus on meaning there by having students reorder the sentences, do true false with the sentences, whatever, some sort of meaning focused task with a dictation. But I kind of came away from this being like, yeah, lots and lots of explicit feedback isn't necessarily going to help students. Maybe focusing on one or two major sort of patterns will help them in that task, and maybe they'll acquire that for the future, but at the very least, we've drawn their attention to something. And so I felt good about the having an input focus and focusing not on marking every single thing up, because also I have 165 students this year. I can't do that. So I think that we have to find realistic solutions for feedback, given that constraint, and then also given that, you know, lots and lots of explicit feedback doesn't really move the needle a lot.
So something that I think with my girl bossing with this is, you guessed it, around structured input. And I'm taking technology for second language instruction right now. And one, like a mini project that we had to do was find an issue in language teaching that could potentially be improved by using technology. And I had started even thinking about this way back at the very, very beginning of the pod. I think it was even episode 2, where we talked about the Lichtman and Gardner article about question asking strategies, which showed improvements in novice learners' subject verb agreement by using either or questions. So, like, because they're getting more input, like, oh, does Ben have a beard? Or does Bill have a beard?
The answer is
That's
Stacy.
right.
Just kidding.
That's right. Ben has a beard. So in TPRS or CI circles, you might hear that being called a threefer, where you get to restate the statement like 3 different times. And I was thinking about, like, okay, so with either or questions, I think this has a lot of potential with upper level students in like multi-clausal sentences, like, for example, using the subjunctive. So what if I only give either or options about the subjunctive part? Because when we're giving those either or questions, we don't have to say the entire sentence. Like, it's so it's like, does Bill want his dog to stop chewing his office chair? Or stop being so darn cute. That's the office chair one presently. And then that led me even more into structured input. So Ben doesn't like this, but I ended up making like a chatbot to help teachers learn and understand how to create structured input activities. And it's pretty darn good. We don't have to put that in the show notes if you don't want to, Ben, because AI, but if anyone wants it, I'm glad to share it. And I'm glad I would really love any kind of feedback, because I can only tell if it works in Spanish, right? Like, I don't know if it works as well in other languages. But yeah, so that was pretty cool. And that's something that I've been girl bossing a little bit, is that little project.
I had some girl boss moments myself when I read this book. One of the things that Travers and Ritz, they spend a lot of time, especially in the beginning, talking about why it's important to teach grammar this way and kind of convincing teachers that just because you learned grammar, in my case, way back in the 80s and 90s, in the like traditional grammar translation method, that doesn't mean that that's what's best for your students. just because that's what you've always done, that's just because it's what it's always been done to you. There is a better way out there. And I'm here to say, yeah, I agree. You don't have to convince me. I'm with you. I walked into this going, I already know that I don't want to teach grammar the old way. I just need to know how to do it the new way. And I feel good about that. I feel like I've been teaching grammar in context for several years now. I've been teaching it when I taught elementary Spanish. Elementary students, they don't really care to sit and listen to a long grammar explanation. They just want to use the language. So that experience really showed me that it's possible. When you teach language with chunks and you teach language focused on communication, you don't need to spend a whole bunch of time explaining how to conjugate verbs. You just use the verbs. And so when I moved from elementary to middle school, I didn't feel the need to go back to the old way I used to teach back at the beginning of my career. And so I'm able to say, I used to teach out of a textbook where I taught verb tenses and I made them memorize them and we made them practice the boot verbs and practice the irregular verbs and practice the stem changing verbs and practice all the different, and we wouldn't, did not move on until everybody in the class had passed and conjugated all the verbs. And you know what? I don't do that anymore. Like at all. Like we don't talk about it. And yet when I give the students a writing task at the end of the year, they're conjugating their verbs at approximately the same rate my students used to decades ago when I was teaching with the old-fashioned method where we spent a whole week talking about this grammar point. Yeah, by the end of the week, they could do it out of context on that, you know, fill-in-the-blank grammar quiz. But then the following week, when I was focusing on vocabulary again and asking them to actually use that grammar point I just taught them, some of them used it. Some of them used it some of the time, and some of them never used it. Well, that's the exact same outcome I'm getting now. Teach grammar through pop-up, teaching grammar through input, teaching grammar through context. My really, really high-flying students are using the grammar by the end of the year without me spending weeks and weeks and weeks drilling it. The vast majority of my students are using it sometime, and my students that struggle still struggle. And because I'm not spending weeks and weeks focusing on grammar, I'm got time to do more input.
Something that I've done a couple times, it's just something that I like to throw in every once in a while when students ask, like, can we practice conjugation? I'm like, you don't need to, because, and then I draw a quick verb chart on the board. And I'm like, how do you say I have? Tengo. All right. How do you say he or she has? Tiene. How do you say we have? Tenemos. How do you say you have? Tienes. How do you say they have? They know it. It's just not been put in boxes. Literally. So yeah, I think same experience with that. And even 1 year I was doing like textbook exercises as my bell ringers to like try to throw in some balance. And I saw just as much growth from doing one activity a day as I did doing the drill, drill, drill. So I like it, I think it helps the students that are curious about the language. And I think maybe we've brought this up at some point, Ben, like if you're already asking if you're asking questions about the grammar, you're probably ready for the explanation because it's something that you've noticed and it's something that's not making meaning. So
my final thought is that I always get more of reading a book when I'm reading it with friends and with colleagues who are thinking about these ideas. And so I really appreciate you guys inviting me to be a part of this project, because if I had been reading this by myself, I probably would have, you know, gotten demotivated and stopped. But I actually, there's a lot of really good stuff in here that I picked up and that I'm using daily in my classes. And so thanks for being a part of this. And I want to give a shout out to all of the people who've been participating on Blue Sky and on Facebook and on all the platforms, that reading your comments has also helped keep me going and helped keep me interested. And, you know, sometimes other people will say something and I'm like, oh, I didn't even notice that in the chapter. And other times it's validating, like, yep, exactly. That's the same
Yeah.
thing that I was worried about or struggling with.
I think was it just today someone was I think it was Enid replied maybe to you about using rubrics, and then we get to like talk about rubrics a little bit more.
So glad
All right.
to have had this. And the book study lives on. Like we said, all across all our social media platforms, there are still comments popping up. So if you revisit this book later, go back to our feeds on Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, find the discussion questions and throw down your answers. It'll make it pop back up in our feed and we can keep the conversation going. Again, we are so thankful to Stacy for joining us and for co-leading this book study with us here in Slaytopia. And I'm looking forward to seeing Stacy at ACTFL in New Orleans very soon. By the time this podcast comes out, it'll be like
Woohoo!
3 days from then. So thank you,
Have
and
so
thank.
much fun.
We'll
Give
miss
each
you
other
there.
hugs for me.
We'll miss you.
Yeah.
We'll miss you there. But if listeners, like we said, if you want to come find us, you will know where Stacy and I are for approximately 1 hour at a time on two separate days. And then otherwise, we hope we run into you. Please come say hi. Otherwise, thanks everybody, and go forth and slay. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.